throughout 2020, but more 2021, it was becoming clear that Taliban are taking control of major parts of the country. After 3 days of struggle, we were finally able to be flown to Germany. And that's my vision in Afghanistan, where human rights are respected, where women and men can equally engage in political, social, and all aspects of life.
Fragile Freedom, Researchers in Exile. Academic freedom is often taken for granted, but it's fragile, especially in authoritarian countries. Scientists are being silenced, threatened, and persecuted. In this live podcast series, researchers in exile share their stories with us.
Welcome to our conversation about fragile freedom at Humboldt University of Berlin. Thank you to the audience on site and to the listeners of the podcast for joining us. My name is Frank Albrecht. I work for the Philip Schwartz Initiative of the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. Many of us will remember the events in Afghanistan in August of 2021. We remember witnessing the rapid fall of the Afghan government and the takeover by the Taliban. We recall the images of Afghan citizens seeking passage into Kabul airport or even clinging to departing military airplanes. We've heard about the radically repressive policies that the Taliban have introduced against women and girls, against minorities, and against civil society as a whole. Today, we will learn about what all this meant for one particular scholar. This scholar is Dr. Suhaila, or Sila Akbari, a fellow of the Philip Schwartz Initiative at Humboldt University of Berlin. Just a word on the Philip Schwartz Initiative. This is a program of the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation, which enables universities, higher education institutions in Germany to host researchers who are displaced from their country of origin because of political persecution or armed conflict. It was launched in 2015 by the Humboldt Foundation together with the Federal Foreign Office. And so far, we've been able to support over 500 researchers from 26 countries. And 34 of these researchers are from Afghanistan. Sila, thank you very much for speaking with me today. Could I ask you to briefly introduce yourself and your field of research?
Thank you so much, Frank, for the nice introduction. It's an honor to be here. And actually, I'm flattered by the turnout of audience and guests. I thought it's a live podcast. Probably friends would prefer to lay on the couch and listen to the podcast. But the fact that you took time and energy to come here, it shows that you have interest in the topic of Afghanistan, and for which I'm so grateful. And did I introduce me briefly? I originally came from north of Afghanistan. Tahar province is a remote, relatively conservative society. I'm born in a family of Tajik and Pashtun. The reason that I'm saying is that we should later talk about how the mindset is about the Pashtun ethnicity, treatment of women, and then its relationship with the Taliban and so on. So in a very progressive family, I was born, although in a very conservative society. I am married, have two daughters. I'm so proud of having two daughters. And I studied Bachelor of Law in Political Science in Kabul University, but did my high school in Tahar. So I have been born and raised in this conservative society of Tahar. And then I did my master's through a Fulbright scholarship in the U.S. Straightforward from there, I came to Germany to do my PhD. But as soon as I was done with my bachelor's, I went back to Tahrir and I started teaching in the newly established law faculty, which was at the time struggling with having law lecturers, let alone having a female law lecturer. So I decided to go back there and give back what that society had given me. And after completing my PhD again, I went back and at this point, I started my political career, legal career, but also remained as an action associate professor in the country and in the country clubs. And I came here. Right now, I am a fellow of Philip Schwartz Initiative, for which I'm so grateful. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation for hosting researchers like us through the Philip Schwartz Initiative. It has helped us a lot. It has not just given us the opportunity to continue our research, but also has provided us with a platform to bring the issue of academic freedom to a broader audience and bring awareness to people, at least in Europe, through this program. Today is an example of such platform and publicity. And also, I would like to thank Humboldt University of Berlin and the supervisors and mentors in this university are great. We have been welcome here. And I personally thank Frank for choosing me for this podcast. It's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this today. So you brought up several really interesting points that you have experienced both in a more rural context in Afghanistan, but also in a very urban context of Kabul. So we'll return to that a little later. But let's have a look at your education and your academic training a bit more closely. You said you started out with political science, but then you moved on. What is your field of research right now?
At the moment, my postdoctoral research focuses on legal frameworks relating to trade in green energy, also to say renewable energy. And throughout my research after PhD, with the climate change issue affecting all aspects of our lives all over the world, I thought, and also I was inspired by my work at the palace in Afghanistan when, for example, I was with my team negotiating energy purchase agreement with neighboring countries, mainly Central Asian countries. And I noticed that Afghanistan has the potential to, at some point, transition to clean energy instead of being all the time dependent on importing fossil fuel energy from neighboring country, which is so costly. And also for this country, because of the environmental and health effects that fossil energy had. And I then noticed, I did some basic research and I noticed that actually the legal frameworks in the area of trade in green energy, transition from trade in fossil energy to green energy, was lacking. And the governments worldwide are taking this very light. They are probably adopting policies and measures generally in the area of transition to renewable energy, but not specifically in trade in clean energy. So I was like, okay, Sila, you should do something that is relevant, that's important. That's what I have been doing since high school. So it's not like what I like most. I see what is at most important for the society and for future. So that's how I picked doing my postdoctoral research in trade in renewable energies.
And what I find interesting is that your training didn't only take place in Afghanistan, but you actually left the country and also pursued, as you said, a PhD in Passau, I think, so in Germany. So you really took up opportunities to get the best training available. One question about your choice of field, it's international trade law. And to me, it feels a bit like this choosing this field is really a sign of optimism for the future of Afghanistan at the time and its place within an international context, so part of an international community. Was that part of the motivation for you to go this direction?
Absolutely, absolutely. During my bachelor studies in Kabul University, which is actually the mother of all universities of Afghanistan, let's say the first ranking university in the country. And in this first ranking university, I noticed that we were struggling with having proper expertise that would teach us international trade law. And it was surprising that some of us, even after graduating, didn't know what World Trade Organization, WTO, was. While when I came to the other parts of the world and I see during the bachelor, everyone knows about almost all the laws of World Trade Organization. So again, as I just said, that for me, it's important to see what the society needs. And then in the beginning, during my high school studies, I actually wanted to be a judge, probably a human rights lawyer, because that's how I went to law school, to be a judge, to be a human rights lawyer in the society. But then this lack of actually expertise in the area of international trade in Afghanistan, in academia in Afghanistan, encouraged me to shift my expertise to international trade. And that's how I wrote my PhD proposal in the law of WTOs with focus on Afghanistan. Then the next point I noticed was we have this very intertwined trade and transit relationship with Pakistan. But Pakistan is the first exporting country partner to Afghanistan and vice versa. As we got membership to the World Trade Organization in 2016, then we had the opportunity to bring certain disputes to the WTO with Pakistan or resolve our issues, if not through negotiation bilaterally, but through WTO. And then I was like, okay, so this is what the country need exports to help Afghanistan. In this case, is probably going to WTO to work for the Afghan delegation. So I wrote my proposal. The case study was the case of trade and transit with Pakistan, which later after my PhD, I was leading the negotiating team with the Pakistani government on signing a new trade and transit agreement. So that's how I have gone ahead.
Yes, and you moved not only into an academic career, but also into a practical career on the policy side. So you have this double profile of being an active member of the Afghan government at the time and as an academic, which is, of course, a particularly special profile. Because if we zoom out a little and if we look at the situation in Afghanistan during those 20 years, in a way, you are a member of a post-Taliban generation. Later, it turns out also a pre-Taliban generation. But how did you perceive the situation? What was the sense of freedom during those 20 years that enabled you to pursue your goals, your career? How do you perceive Afghanistan as a whole, as a society, during those 20 years?
Thank you. It's a very interesting question. Unlike some neighboring countries, that the society and the people are different from the government, in Afghanistan, it was actually the other way around. Throughout 20 years of my life in Afghanistan, there was no particular restriction, by the government, by the policies, to impose any certain restriction for women. If you open our constitution, Republic Constitution, you would see that all women and men, they have equal rights. This is amazing, right? Everything was just equal. And then good for all those girls and women that could use this opportunity, that they're societies and families allowed to do that. So in a public political sphere, we had this democratic government, democratic policies and regulation, including constitution. But then when you would come to the society, it was different. It was getting much, much better. In the beginning, it was difficult because the society was still conservative. Imagine Taliban in the first era had ruled Afghanistan for 5 years. All the accomplishments before that were vanished. So 5 years changed the mentality of the societies. Again, people were conservative. And for people, it was shocking to see after 2001 for certain years to see girls going university, for example, or not having a certain way of Islamic hijab. It was the society challenges, but then there were families like my family who stood by the girls, women, and supported them. When I say that, okay, I went to Kabul, then I went to US, then I came. It's not like that. It's like my father has fought with whole Tahar province. God knows how much bad things he, my mother, and my family might have heard in the beginning. That's true. Like at some points, my dad, I remember clearly that even his eyes got watery, and it was like he wanted me to get married after my master, for which I was not still ready. And was like, Sila, you have no idea how much I have hurt, how much burden I have taken on my shoulder to let you travel all the world and to be where you are today. So see, the society was conservative, but then it was getting better. And during 2002, 2006, or 2007, probably people would look different way when I was in Kabul. But then in 2010, you would see those same family that has a negative perception of letting girls going out of province for study. They were letting their girls go actually Kabul, stay in hostel and study. So the society was transforming for better, and it was optimistic for all of us. But then, like any other societies, especially in third world countries, especially in Islamic traditional communities, we cannot exclude the culture and the tradition completely. And overnight, we think that, okay, all the liberal, shiny things of the Western style, let's say, should be implemented. That's just impossible. That's not practical. And I don't agree with that. So we had our problems, but the good things are we were taking opportunities for progress.
So you were just describing that, of course, a society such as the Afghan society has different areas, and you were familiar with the situation in Kabul, but also with the more rural provinces. But the situation was improving all over the country, maybe at different paces. And then we come to 2021. And at the time, you were still both active within the government. You led an office of the, you were part of the office of the president, but also you had an academic position at a university. Could you take us through the developments leading up to the fall of the Afghan government, so in the months and years preceding the fall of the Afghan government?
Throughout 2020, but more 2021, it was becoming clear that Taliban are taking control of major parts of the country, that the system was changing probably in where the Doha negotiation over a peace deal with the Taliban between the US, which is ridiculous. It was about Afghanistan, but the deal was between the US and the Taliban over the future of Afghanistan. It was becoming clear that the system would change, the political power would shift it, and we should have been ready for such a change. But what most of us didn't imagine was that the Taliban would have been the same Taliban of 20 years back. There were a lot of lobbies going on that no, the Taliban are changed, including the European countries, including the US, that no, the Taliban is not the Taliban of the 20 years ago. But some of us, including me, who were writing from time to time, that no, Taliban are not changed, because at every negotiation, the Taliban was saying, okay, we will respect women's rights, but in accordance with Islamic law. And then we were questioning this Islamic law framework for women's rights, because that's so different from the real Islamic rules for women's rights from that of the Taliban. So we had this nightmare. Women like me had this nightmare that would be worse for Afghan women and girls. But we were working. It's so astonishing that now that I reflect that even the last week of the collapse, we were negotiating with Pakistani delegation over a trade and transit agreement with Central Asian for the energy purchase, with Iran a strategic agreement. We and a lot of other projects were going on. and the Taliban was the back door of doors of Kabul. What we miscalculated was, including the president, that the Taliban would not enter Kabul at least the next 1 or 2 months, because that was the initial deal with Americans. But then this rush collapse happened all of a sudden, and the regime was collapsing. We see what happened and what is happening since then. But the developments, sometimes some people say, okay, this is Afghanistan problem. Afghan people should, I don't know how to even put this, but I see it not Afghanistan problem. I see it as international community's problem, at the top of them, US problem, because it was the US that decided if the Taliban would come or not, if the former government would stay or not. So the developments, everything that happened during 2020, during 2021, it was arrangement between the US and the Taliban, and we see the consequences now.
In the end, it turned out not to be months until the Taliban took Kabul, but just weeks, which takes us right into the middle of this infamous August of 2021.
I hate this number.
I think I understand. Still, I'm going to ask. You don't have to respond, of course, but how did you personally experience the fall of Kabul, of Afghanistan? What happened to you and your family?
Here, my older daughter was like, Mama, I want to go and attend the conference. She was 4.5 years old when we were stranded in Kabul airport. She's so traumatized that, God forbid, if she confronts the police outside, she thinks the police is Taliban. She has done that, and she screams, and she thinks that the police would shoot us. But she was old enough to experience all these traumas. And it's interesting that in the morning of the collapse of Kabul, 16 August, I was going to work. Unlike other days, we were told at the main gate. So this palace was like a long way to reach our office, 2-3 kilometers from the main gate. Usually we would go to the second gate, and then from there we would walk to our offices, the main palace. But this day, this particular day at the main gate, they tell us that no, today no cars are allowed. So please walk to your offices. And then we walk 2 kilometers, I don't know how many kilometers, to our offices. We go to our offices, and it's a strange atmosphere. And everyone is just closing and going back. So we are told that, okay, today go back home. And it's not like 5 minutes or so that I entered my office. And I did not even sign off my account, so Taliban access to all my information if they came to my office. So we came back, and then in this time frame of probably 1 hour that I get to office, then I come back, I see myself on the street with a horror, like a horror film. People are running, taxis are stopped, cars are stopped. There's no taxi, no car to take you because roads are blocked. And then you walk from this route to another route, and you see that the military tanks switched on, but with no personnel, with no driver. And everyone is rushing and running, kids from school, women from work crying. And then, okay, Taliban are entering Kabul. And I'm like, no, I must be dreaming. It can't be true. We, till yesterday, till this morning, we were going to work. How it can be possible to witness this? And then I finally walk home. It takes me 1 hour or 2 hours to walk home from the office with blisters, food, of course. And then a friend from America texts me that Sila rushed to airport. You have to rush. And I don't think of running to airport till this point, because I can't believe the Taliban are entering Kabul. And then what I do is, because this credible source told me to rush to the airport, then I just pick my younger daughter, Eva. She was 4 months, roughly 4 or 5 months old at the time, a baby. And I pack a pack of formula with 2-3 diapers. Then I rush with a small backpack to the airport. And there it is. Within the next hour, Taliban are on the streets of Kabul, but they cannot enter Kabul airport. See how crazy it is. It's a deal between the U.S. and between Taliban that until we evacuate all our personnel, all our military staff, you cannot enter Kabul airport. So the Taliban are all over the city, but not the Kabul airport. We are inside the terminal. And you saw on the news, yeah, with the airplanes, with the rush of people and people running on the run. Probably I was one of them. And then I witnessed two women being shot with American snipers. I witnessed a child died suffocated when people were running. It was like day of judgment. You have to run the first chance you see an airplane. If God forbid this temple, and then you're done because no one would care to hold you. 2-3 days were there at Passau, in Passau city. People get to know that the Afghan legal scholar doing her PhD is now in Kabul, stranded. And oh my God, I'm in awe of Passau. I'm in awe of Passauers and the people because everyone just rushed in.
Just as a reminder, yes. You had done your PhD at the University of Passau, so you were very familiar to the faculty there.
Yes. So actually it is Passau, it's Passau's people who saved me. Because from mothers, from kindergarten of my older daughter, my university, everyone that knew me, they called their representatives in the parliament, the ministries, journalists, like everyone that this woman is in the airport and she must be saved by German military. And I was fortunate because the Secretary of the Defense Minister of Germany messaged me that, okay, we know about you, you are on the list, you will be rescued by German military. But it took 3 days because of the runway being blocked, the aircraft not being able to land. After 3 days of a struggle and with 41 degrees Celsius, hot summer, with no water, with no food, but that was okay. We were finally able to be flown to Germany. But that's a very, very traumatic experience because at some point, the third day, the Taliban came actually to the civilian part of the airport, and they were pushing. So it's good to know that why people were on the runway. The reason people were on the runway, the Taliban was forcing us to go to the runway. And then from there, on the other part of the runway, which the military part of the airport and the American forces were, they were warning us that, no, you should not come to this part. So we were in a very forcible situation that we could not go back because Taliban would shoot us, like really shoot us. And we could not go to the American side of the airport because they were with the snipers were warning us. So what we were doing, including me and my two kids, we were just running on the runway. What you watch in the news. And we were here.
Let's take a breath for just a second, maybe a sip of water. So after that ordeal, you arrive in Germany and you and your daughters are at least physically safe in Germany. What were the first steps you took? What happened when you arrived in Germany?
I am one of those rare but lucky people who had already networked in Germany. So for me, finding myself back in Germany was not that difficult. I knew people who knew me. I had an educational background from Germany. So it was not difficult for me to settle down. And the next step was, okay, so I needed at least a year, but I started after 6 months. But now that I reflect, I think I did not give myself much time to heal. Because I was rushing, like I have always been used to, okay, still us, what you should do now? Okay, do this, do that, contact this fellowship, program this and that. And then sometimes I noticed that I was so exhausted that I cried during nights and I rushed to institutions, to people, to research during the day. So after some time, I was lucky enough to be selected for Philip Schwarz Initiative. And then I started my postdoctoral research. My kids, I started a school this year. She turned six, and Eva goes to kindergarten, and we are safe and sound here. Of course, I'm homesick. I will always be homesick. Because for me, I was a very ideal woman who dreamed of Afghanistan all the time. That's why you see, I come Kabul, I rush back to Tehran. I go to US, I rush back to Afghanistan. I come to Germany the next day after my PhD, I rush back to Afghanistan. For me, like, Afghanistan was my responsibility. So for me, it's not easy to think that I can forget Afghanistan. But here, we're also impressed by people. We are welcomed by people. People value the value of education and science. And that's how I'm being treated by people. That is, I think, the chance that I have here.
So now you're a researcher, as you said, at Humboldt University in Berlin. How did you find your academic mentor? How did you find support? How were you included here in the faculty?
First of all, to choose Berlin, I needed a change from Passau. I needed a new environment, a bigger environment. So I did my research and I found a chair that was relevant to my scientific background. And I emailed the supervisor. I introduced myself and he was so welcoming. He was so supportive that why not go ahead? I'm your supervisor. And he still supports me that way. And once I had the confirmation that he would be my supervisor, then I applied to Philipp Schwarz.
So now that you've done work here, and I know that part of the political actors here in Germany have sought your advice and your, have consulted you, and you've spoken to other groups and contexts also in the context of the Philipp Schwarz Initiative. Do you feel you and your work, your professional expertise are appreciated and valued here in Germany?
Well, it depends, really. If you talk about my trade law expertise and my renewable energy expertise, I would say not that much, because many, many established scholars out there, scientists out there with deeper background in this field, yeah, with much more in-depth expertise in Germany with the Swedish Sprache, yeah. Ich kann noch nicht gut Deutsch sprechen. Ja, ich schäme mich.
Sie sprechen ausgezeichnet Deutsch, just as an aside.
Das ist wie Straßensprache. Ich brauche ein bisschen Zeit. Aber danke. So yes, that's so difficult to compete in this environment. The environment is so competitive. But when it comes to, and also my expertise focus more on Central Asia, in Asia, and that's also a little bit different. But when it comes to Afghanistan in general, education, science, then of course, it's very much appreciated. I get contacts from organizations, from relevant bodies in get invited to events, conferences, or they seek my opinion regarding certain legal issues. And that's, yes, appreciated.
And again, I'm sure that your double profile as a government official and as an academic is hopefully helpful.
Yes, yes. I have a blended experience of serving at a public policy level with the government and also in academia. So that's a fortunate point.
But let's turn back to Afghanistan and the developments since 2021 there. I think most of us are aware about the developments regarding civil liberties, the situation of women, of girls and minorities. How does the Afghan society cope with Taliban rule? And is there a difference between Kabul or urban areas and rural areas? How is your perspective on the situation in the Afghan civil society?
In general context, because Afghan people have suffered so much from 30, 20, 40 years of civil wars, that at some point they were so tired that they were satisfied with having security. not necessarily security means having peace and peace of mind, but security. So they thought, okay, now that the Taliban is here, probably there would be security, no more war. But then as time passes by and they see this restriction, and they see that Taliban focus more on ordinary social stuff rather than adapting and applying policies on major topics such as economic development, trade, governance, and so on and so forth. They stick to women, they stick to girls. And now, as I am in contact with people in Afghanistan, in my own province, they are very pessimistic. And the unemployment rate is skyrocketing, and it's very disastrous for people, because more than 70% of Afghan population is young. And these young people need job market. And without job and without income, of course, the society and the living would be disastrous for them. And also with regard to restriction on women on a regular basis, with the latest edict last week, it is the 100th edict that Taliban passes on women alone. But you would see no economic policy, no economic measure over the past 3 years. So people, yes, people are conservative, people are tired of security, but people also need employment, need peace of mind, need education, and need inclusive governing and social and political engagement, which is lacking hugely in Afghanistan under the Taliban. So it's a situation of trauma, a disappointment, and mental sickness in the country, as much as it is physical sickness also.
Women have been excluded from pursuing any professional activity. They've been excluded from universities. Girls have been excluded from any education, from starting from secondary education, so only primary schools are open. I think a few months ago, a new decree was passed that even a woman's voice is deemed unacceptable in public. So since 2021, it's been a continuous development of rapid repression of freedoms. At the same time, at least at the beginning, we learned that under this huge blanket of repression against females, against minorities like the Hazara, there were like pockets of civil resistance. For example, people turning a basement room into a classroom and teaching girls that shouldn't be taught according to the Taliban. There were members of the Afghan diaspora doing online classes wherever they could. Is there still a chance to do that? Is it still possible to have those pockets of civil resistance?
In major cities like Kabul, Herat, or Mazar, I have heard that underground schooling is going on by some diasporas from outside, but that operates in a state of fear, because by the time the Taliban learns, those underground schools will be closed, but under a different name. For example, capacity building training, like sewing or other womanly crafts for women, these underground schools are operating. Online schools are going on. I'm not sure how effective online schooling would be, because we just cannot throw some online initiatives and think the whole country would access to it. First of all, we have huge energy deficiency, energy problem in Afghanistan. And if you don't have energy, electricity, how would you attend online class? Second of all, not every girl, especially girls in secondary school, have phones and tablets. How will you provide that? Even if you provide that with energy, then from where would you have internet to provide that? So I'm really not sure about the success of online schooling. I'm very much pro underground schools. Probably at some points I should do that also, at least in Tahar, because for me, mental health is also important from personal experience. Imagine yourself locked for 2 months at home with no outdoor touch, how would you feel after 2 months? If mentally you are not in social contact with others, especially with your own age, with your own peers, it would eventually affect all aspects of your life. So even if it is underground schools, it would give girls the opportunity to go, to listen to each other, to cry, to put their heads on the shoulders of one another and tell each other the sorrows and the pains that they have. Very rare in major cities, these initiatives are going on, and I hope that it would extend to other provinces, to remote areas, but that would depend to how much safety they would have from the Taliban and also how much fun they would have, because they could not be offered freely.
And add to that the situation, the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, which we cannot forget. There have been earthquakes, flooding. So right now, Afghanistan is facing one of the globally worst humanitarian crises. So looking at this entire situation, what is it that you, if you could change the world, would hope the international community would do? And what is it doing?
Oh my God, if I cannot change the world. Oh, that's a very huge question, Frank. But if I could change the world, I would first of all just turn on one of these lights, not all of them. Because this is how, I'm sorry, I have to be frank, right? This is how we protect climate change. And as I said, as my expertise is about green energy, you have no idea how much greenhouse gas emissions are produced through fossil fuel energy, these energies. I would not turn light during the day in my office. But regarding Afghanistan, I think I should be the U.S. to decide this, because pretty much it's the U.S. who decide. Oh my God, I have to be so honest. Nowadays, all over the world, yes? Frankly, policies around the world, countries, the last word is from the U.S., whether it is war, whether it is peace, whatever. So if I was to change something and I was in a position, I would either set a red line with the Taliban to accept women's rights, human rights, come into terms, or eliminate them. And I would be in that position to eliminate them. The U.S. is in position to do anything, literally. So they could, but they don't, because it's not in their interest at the moment. And honestly, I wouldn't care if the Taliban would rule Afghanistan for the next 10 years or 20 years. As long as they change, they respect, not just respect, let people exercise their human rights, their women rights, establish an inclusive government, and let the minorities exercise their rights, then the Taliban can rule Afghanistan for the rest of their life. We wouldn't have any problem. Because whether we accept it or not, Afghanistan is an Islamic, a traditional country. We would not have any problem with women wearing hijab. You say or no, women wear hijab. I was wearing hijab. Although if I would go outside bare head, the government wouldn't tell me anything. But I choose to do that because that's how the country is. So we are an Islamic country. Taliban can rule their country if they change their policies. But the thing is that they don't change, and it is for international community at the top, the U.S., to set a strict red line and come in from negotiation. Every now and then something comes up and that's a green light for us. Okay, international community is caring about us. But then the next minute you see that there is a deal with the Taliban, some sort of soft negotiation where the Taliban are allowed to demand what they want. And then you see no negotiations with an enemy like Taliban would not go this way. So there should be solid, concrete red lines while negotiating and entering into dialogue with the Taliban. If not, then at some points, the international community gives the final warning to the Taliban.
As a last question for you personally, what is a vision you would develop for yourself and your family for the near future, further down the road? Would you want to go back and rebuild as soon as it was safely possible?
Yeah, Yes, Frank. I would go as soon as possible. The country is safe. I would teach at the universities. I continue what I was doing. I would work for the government, deal with trade and economic issues. And that's my vision for me and for Afghanistan. And Afghanistan, no matter who is in the power, in Afghanistan, where human rights are respected, where women and men can equally engage in political, social, and all aspects of life. And Afghanistan that has a stable relationship with other countries, that has a recognition at international platform. And Afghanistan that as women and girls can come here, stand up and talk at international arenas in labor. That's the vision I have for Afghanistan. And for myself, I'm academic. With my experience with the government, I think I'm now more pro-working both at academic level but also at practical level. So personally, if I pursue my career in the next 5 years or 10 years, I would be open to work in academia and also probably with the government. German government or European Union or law firms where I can bring my expertise into practice and also learn from the practice of NGOs, firms or government bodies. And I want to raise my two daughters as strong, as resilient as other Afghan girls and daughters are.
What a closing statement. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Fragile Freedom. This live podcast series is brought to you by Congressa in collaboration with the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. Visit our website for more episodes and resources. The project is funded by the Federal Ministry of Education and Research as part of the Science Year 2024, Freedom.